and welcome to another JobPod podcast. Today I'm talking to Professor James Essen from Queen Mary University of London. James, congratulations on your new professorship at the School of Geography, and thanks very much for agreeing to join me on JobPod today.
Hi John, and thank you for having me, and thanks for the congratulations also. It still hasn't quite sunk in yet. And oddly enough, my kids are normally quite brash with me, but this is one thing they said, Dad, that's actually quite cool. Thanks, John, for the congratulations.
Are they going around the house calling you prof?
Not quite, but they call me other things that I won't say on the podcast. but they, for once, they think this is quite cool. They weren't convinced I was a real doctor, but they've accepted I'm a professor, which is quite nice.
Excellent. Now then, your research cuts across development and political and population geography, so that gives us an awful lot that we can chat about. I want to start with, a delightful quote that you sent me as we were discussing the podcast, because you said, "I'm a critical scholar who tries to use a geographical lens to explore, question, and improve the world around us." And as I read some of the work that you've done, you go beyond that, actually, because you also... you invite your students, and through the public engagement that you do, you invite the public to view the world through that same geographical lens, to encourage everybody to explore, question, and improve the world around us. Now, not everyone sees geography in that way, to be honest. I had some phone calls when I was program manager at the Geographical Association. People would ring up and say to me, "What's the point of geography? My son, daughter wants to do geography, and I'd rather they were a doctor. I'd rather they were an engineer." You look as though you've been driven towards this career path quite from an early age. Would that be right? What turned you into a geographer?
It's a really, really great question, John. And I'd actually say that the older I get, the more of a geographer I think I'm becoming. I'm becoming quite protective of the discipline. But no, I think when I look back... of course, there's a range of influences as to why we end up doing what we're doing. But I think two really stand out to me. The first is slightly more personal. So my mum was one of 13 kids. She has lots of siblings. I've got lots of cousins, aunts and uncles, many of them who live in Gardner, some of them who live in London, and the UK, Canada, all over the world. And growing up in my household and when I went to family events, people are always asking questions about themselves, about the world. And if you thought something, people are often keen to know why you thought what you did, in a very kind of, I wouldn't say confrontational, but a curious way. So I think I've always grown up in an environment where people are asking questions about the world around us and also how we see ourselves in the world. And of course, well, you wouldn't know this, but I was born in Ghana. I moved to the UK when I was about 2-3 years old. So when I go to Ghana, they say you sound like a Brit. But when I'm in the UK, they ask me where I'm from. So that's an interesting conversation, maybe for later on. So I've always been fascinated by place and our place in the world, right? So you can imagine as a child going to school, in the 1980s, giving a bit of a clue about how old I am here in primary school. You see things like comic relief, you'd hear about Band-Aid, you know, people singing, "Do They Know It's Christmas?" and talking about Africa in ways that didn't make any sense to me. Like, that wasn't the Africa that I knew, right? So I think from a very early age, I started to ask questions about the world, my place in the world. And I think to your point about becoming a geographer from an early age, I think that's partly what drove it, trying to understand, as I said, my place in the world and how others saw me within the world. So I hope that kind of answered your question partly there from a more personal perspective. But from an educational perspective, I had a fantastic secondary school teacher in year 9 through to my GCSEs called Mrs. Yameen. And she was fantastic. And I said to myself, you know, what made Mrs. Yameen so interesting? And it's because I think she's quietly subversive. She's a very critical scholar and she's Mrs. Yameen. So again, I'm using gender pronouns there. And she's a physical geographer, right? So again, when even as a young child, you have these ideas of what a geographer looks like, what geographers do. I had a woman teaching me physical geography, right? And it was just fascinating. And I think she was always very quietly subversive and asked us to challenge and think about the world in quite critical ways. So I think that really fundamentally shaped how I view the discipline. You know, and I think that's also partly why, for me, I'm very mindful that, you know, you made the point earlier on about people saying, what's the point in geography? I'm always very conscious that it does depend on who taught you geography in many ways, like many subjects, right? And I think that we may get this later on, but I'm not always so sure that we really teach geography in the best light at school. Again, that might be a conversation for later, but I hope that gives you a little bit of an insight into kind of the early foundations of why I kind of fell in love with the discipline. And as I say, Mrs. Yameen was just fantastic in terms of, you know, taking the curriculum and teaching what needed to be taught, but ask you to question and ask questions about the world around you, you know, and being quite quick. If, for example, someone made a comment about a particular part of the world, be very quick to challenge them on it. And like, so why do you think that? And in a very kind of dialogic way, and in a very pedagogically sensitive way, but just forcing us to ask questions about the world around us. So does that answer your question, John?
Yes, it does. And it's interesting because one of the papers I read is about why is our geography curriculum so white? And this posed a question for me about what the geography is doing that keeps it white and what we ought to do to change. And I'd like to talk about that later. But I want to come to something you said about working with Black populations, first of all, because this is an area that I think we need to be looking at. You talk about working with Black populations located in the conspicuous margins. And I didn't understand what you meant by that.
Yeah, and that's pretty good example of an academic probably overthinking something quite simple and straightforward. But I guess for me, and I'll very briefly start with a broader point about this idea of the conspicuous margin. So I had a great colleague at Loughborough University, Professor Darren Smith, and he once said to me a couple of years ago, he said, James, what exactly do you do? You know, I read your work, I think it's really interesting, but if you had to summarize in a sentence what you do, what would it be? And I sat back and thought to myself, we all do stuff, we know why we're doing it, but do we really know what we're doing it and what we're doing? And that's where I started to think, okay, so what is it that drives me as a geographer? What motivates me? And of course, you can do the things retrospectively and create a narrative that didn't exist. But for me, I've realized I've always been driven by what I've just said, people at the conspicuous margins. And what I mean by that is, and it's partly inspired by a fantastic scholar called Bell Hooks, who talked about how in society, right, we have, you know, think society as a body, right? The margins are part of the body, but they're on the outskirts. They're part of the whole, but not quite part of the whole. I've always been fascinated by people that are positioned in that way, who are on the fringe of society that perhaps, as the word says, they're marginalized and don't quite get quite enough attention. But at the same time, people who, on the one hand, don't get attention, but are actually very visible to us. So an obvious example, this would be, as I said, Black populations. If you think about Black culture, if you looked in, it's a bit embarrassing, I don't follow the charts that strongly these days, but I get the sense that Black culture is quite prominent. You know, you have lots of famous Black musicians, Black actors, Black sports stars. We're highly visible and present within society. At the same time, Black populations do quite clearly exist in the margins. If you think about the Black Lives Matter movement, issues of racial injustice, Black people still even have debates about what it means to be working class, as an example. So often when we think about the working class in Britain, we think about that as a racialized group of people, often white populations. We often don't think about Black people as being working class. And COVID-19 highlighted quite dramatically and quite significantly that many Black people are amongst the working class. We're on the front lines in lots of public service and sectors, right? And I think that was perhaps, that's probably the best example I can give you in terms of thinking about the conspicuous margins in Black life. COVID-19. Black people were very much at the forefront of COVID in terms of catching the virus, death rates, infections, all of those things. Because our position in these often frontline roles, but these roles at the same time often quite invisible, they're quite in the margins, people don't think about them. So again, that probably articulates what I mean by the conspicuous margins in a more kind of tangible sense. But intellectually, as I kind of hinted, I've looked, and as you mentioned earlier on, I've looked at, for example, the trafficking of West African youth through the football industry. So again, Black athletes are very prominent, but very few of us think about the idea of a Black athlete being trafficked, especially a West African athlete being trafficked. So again, this on the margins of the football industry, something that seems quite peripheral. At the same time, Black athletes are highly conspicuous and visible. So does that make sense, John?
It does. But then we take that further and say, right, that there are Black artists, there are Black sports people. But a paper that you wrote in 2018, The Why and the White, was in response to an article by Mona Domosh. And we look at this at a conference and look at the audience. Why is our geography curriculum so white? Why are there so few, when we've talked about the number of Black people in music, the number of Black people in sport, the number of Black people in other elements, why is our geography curriculum so white? And you talk about going into the why and the white in that question.
Yeah, no, thanks, John. And I guess I'll also begin by being a little bit honest here and say that the paper I really wanted to write was the how and the white. How is the curriculum so white? But that was an intellectual paper that I wasn't quite ready to write, and maybe I'll never be ready to write it. So I think that's a far more difficult question, actually, the how and the white, because I think the why and the white becomes apparent when we think about, for example, If you think at UK geography, Professor Vandana Desai at Royal Holloway did a fantastic paper kind of breaking down some of the numbers, looking at, for example, how many in the paper she describes them as black minority ethnic students go on to do geography. So relative to other disciplines, we have quite a low number of geography students at undergraduate level. So for example, where on other subjects, the average is around 16%, geography is around 4.4%. Then when you start to think about who go on to become staff, most disciplines is around 8 to 10%, geography is around 4.3%. When you think about who go on to do PhDs, the number goes down even more. Professors, back when Vandana Desai did the paper 2017, something like 7.3% of UK professors are black, minority ethnic. Geography was 1.4%. And for me, I think the issue, and this is not to, and I want to be very clear at this point, this is not to have a dig at school teachers. School teachers do a fantastic job under quite considerable pressure. But often people try to fix this issue at university level, and I think it begins a lot earlier. Right, it's a very personal story. My eldest son is 15, doing GCSEs. He dropped geography. Can you imagine? And I won't say where he goes to school, and I hope this never gets out because it's not a criticism of the school that he goes to. But he decided geography wasn't for him. And that blows my mind that somebody would think geography isn't for them. Because for me, I don't see how you could not love geography. But to your earlier question, the reason why our discipline looks so wise the way it is that at every stage we go, people stop doing geography, as in black or minority ethnic, as people have said in that paper, racial minorities, whatever term you would like to use, the numbers start to get lower and lower and smaller and smaller. So there's a demographic question in terms of who does the discipline. But then when we think about the subjects in a more kind of take a step back, look at the subject in terms of how we teach and what we're teaching, one thing that geography does quite badly, I'd say, at undergraduate level, but also perhaps at higher education, is that if you look at the geography GCSE curriculum, for example, there's a lot of comparison and hierarchies. And it constructs the world in quite a binary way. For example, developed, underdeveloping. We don't use those terms so much anymore, as an example. And I think what that does is it creates and reinforces certain types of stereotypes, but also subtly, well, actually some would argue quite explicitly, promote certain forms of supremacy, right? So Eurocentrism, the idea that the West is best, and other parts of the world are viewed in quite problematic ways. And again, this is all very, very subtle, especially if you think about the curriculum doesn't explicitly say Europe is better than the rest of the world, for example, or that Africa is highly problematic. But if you think about how Africa as a continent is taught in the curriculum, it's often from a point of deficit, right? About what Africa lacks relative to other parts of the world. Africa is also seen as a totality. So rather than thinking about the subtleties and nuances within certain places and space within the continent, as I said, it's often stereotyped and seen in quite negative ways. And last but not least, because the breadth of what is covered, we don't really get the chance to look at the depth. So we often have quite, I would say, I mean, in a respectful way, slightly superficial understandings of different parts of the world. And when you layer that onto this idea of comparison and hierarchy, it does reinforce quite problematic racial stereotypes about the world.
I know if I was still teaching A-level, I'd be thinking differently. We had a link with a school in Zanzibar, in Makinduchi, in the second city. And so I'm a geography teacher going over there. And we flew in and we had an escort because the government thought it was very high profile. So we had these guards all looking very, very straight-faced with their machine guns. So my first impression of the country was of this sort of approach. And I'd seen the things on TV where young children, problem is they've always got a problem. That's how they're always portrayed on TV. And it was the rainy season when we went, and John, my mate, fell over as we were getting out of the Jeep. And it was the bit of Makinduchi where it's red clay. So he was absolutely covered. And there was this humongous amount of laughter. It was the primary school children had been looking out the window, seeing him fall over. And they all piled out to watch. The teacher came out as well, looking at the white Mzungu who'd fallen over. They had exactly the same sense of humour. And I was thinking, oh, that's not really what I was expecting. And we went to see the minister. He wasn't there. So his wife put the telly on. And she said, oh, this is one of my favourite programmes. And we sat and we watched Mr. Bean. Honestly, so we're in the minister's house with the minister's wife watching Mr. Bean. And same sense of humour, if just we could get that sort of thing over to young people sometimes, they wouldn't have the same sense of other, which you talked about, when you do differences before you do similarities. We should always look at similarities first. whenever we're doing a comparison. These children might walk to school a lot further or whatever when you're doing that sort of comparison, but they still laugh at the same things. They still play football. They still do they have the same hopes and dreams. They're still the same people. But that doesn't come across quite often.
And that's where I think I want to be very clear, and I hope it came through, that it's not a dig at the school teachers. I don't think they've got the time or the space to do this level.
Well, nor is the curriculum sometimes asking the right questions.
And that's why I think it requires more of a structural change to realise the geography we want to realise. It requires deep-seated change. But to your point, I do think that geography at the moment, it starts with a point of difference and deficit. So, you know, you asked me about teachers and what we could do differently. I think that if I had to give them just, you know, what they call the soundbite, avoid difference and deficit would be the soundbite, and try to make your curriculum far more humane and look at similarities between people and places as a starting point. What connects us? What our similarities are? And that also might lead to some really difficult conversations. A similarity might be the legacy of colonialism and empire. That might be what connects us, actually. You know, and again, these are conversations that we don't always have as part of the geography curriculum. You know, I often smile when Black History Month is when we decide to talk about slavery. But it's often about slavery from the perspective of what happened to Black populations, but not so much about the role of white populations in that slavery. That bit often kind of is less talked about. So I think that a soundbite would definitely be try to avoid coming from a place of deficit and difference, and to think more about similarities and what connects us is a key thing I would say. And to your brilliant point about perspective and voice, I think is really important. So you know, I think that I've talked briefly about the demographics of the discipline and how it looks. It's improving, I think. Anecdotally, I feel like it's improving. And hopefully the new figures might show that when we get them at some point in the next few years. But I would say the way we teach the discipline reproduces that whiteness quite considerably. And that's why I think for me, the smarter paper, the stronger paper, would have probably been the how and the white. So how is it doing this work? Luckily for us, there's people like Chris Winter, you know, who was at Sheffield University, Dr. Chris Winter, who's doing some great stuff on the curriculum. Other people are doing it as well. Iram Sama at King's College London is doing a great PhD, look at decolonizing the geography school curriculum. There's some really great work being done at the moment, but I think the how and the white would have been a far more powerful, interesting question to have asked, but I didn't quite have the intellectual ability to do at that time.
No, I think that's right. And what struck me with what you do with your population studies, you use ethnogeography to talk to people and get people's stories. Population studies is more about people rather than numbers and graphs. And it's about getting a sense of place for the various different people that inhabit that same place and what their stories are like, which we don't do if we see geography as a population overview with graphs.
100%. And I think that what I've tried to do with a lot of my research, without going to the detail, because I don't think listeners will probably care that much about the detail, but a lot of the work that was done in the past in kind of human trafficking and to some extent in the sport context was very quantitative. It was very much about big picture stories, which they're important. We need those big picture stories, but you lost sight of the human beings in the processes. And what I was very keen to do with my work was to try to tease out the human stories, the human accounts, the lived realities of people. Because I think it's quite important to do that, because what that then starts to do is help us to understand better why these things are happening, right? So I have a paper called Better Off at Home, looking at football trafficking. And within that paper, I provide some really rich accounts of stories. There's one story, these are all pseudonyms, of course, and I've anonymized them, but there's a young boy from Guinea called Gerard. And he was very good at football. He played for a local team. He was spotted by a stronger team, moved up to that level. And then a so-called scout from Europe came to Guinea, saw Gerard playing, promised him all sorts, a trial at a top club in Europe, in France. Gerard's family sold their family land to raise funds to send him to Europe for this trial. Lo and behold, there was no trial. And the agent took the money and left Gerard in Paris. Now, of course, that's a shocking story. It's not very nice. It's very horrible. And but what Gerard did, as I spoke to him and other boys and young men in Paris, is that they started to articulate the why this process happens. You know, why is it that somebody can come to Guinea and promise you you'd have a trial at a club in France, your family would sell all their, well, a key piece of their family land to raise the funds for you to go on this trip? Like, why does that work? Why does it happen? And we start to get an understanding of deeper structural inequalities in the world. between the haves and the have-nots. I'll tell you a story, John, that is funny, but it isn't funny. So Gerard said to me that, you know, as a child, he used to watch the Tour de France, right on TV. And he said he realized that in Europe, people are so rich, they could stand by the side of a road and not have to go to work just to watch a bike go past them. People, that, imagine being that rich that you could stand by the side of the road, not caring the world, to literally watch a bike whiz past you on a hill. He says that's what we want in Africa, but we can't have it in Africa. So where can we have that? In Europe and other places. So we want to go to those places. And I think that's really important because often with human trafficking, we think of it as an issue of poverty. It's about inequality. If everybody was poor, human trafficking would look very, very different. What traffickers are able to do quite well is exploit the inequalities between places, right? So it becomes geographical. And that's what to me is quite beautiful geographically. It's about place and space, about mobility. It's also about time and temporality. So for example, how a state treats an 18-year-old victim of human trafficking is very different to how they treat a 15-year-old, because one's a minor and one's seen as having majority in society, right? So again, so there's a temporal dimension. And again, if you think of geography, space, place, scale, time, lots of these key concepts, you know, they provide a really powerful lens to understand the world and the issues. And that's why I said earlier on that for me, geography is quite important as a lens. I think one of the things I try to encourage my students not to do is fall into the trap of very blinkered and extremist views of the world. If you think about the concept of the so-called culture wars, where people have these quite stark positions, I'm not going to get into whether they're right or wrong, but they're quite stark positions, and they fail to see the complexity and nuance. And I think what geography does quite powerfully is that if you use a geographical lens to see an issue, it forces you to contextualize it and to see it in a bigger picture, in a broader context. If you think about it through space, place, scale, time as examples, it forces you to have a far more, as I said, nuanced perspective on an issue. And that's why I think a geographical lens is quite powerful. And that's the kind of lens I try to apply to the case of human trafficking involving male West African youth. And to go back to our earlier conversation, when people often think of human trafficking, they don't think of men normally. They very rarely think of Black men or Black teenagers. So again, it's a population that often goes under the radar, is on the margins of these debates, and I wanted to bring their voices to the fore. And in doing so, start to articulate how who you are also shapes how you're treated in various contexts as a victim of human trafficking. And that might be a conversation for a different day, but I hope that's kind of giving you a bit of a flavour and a taste for some of the work I've done in that space.
No, I think that's interesting. All the A-level specs talk about international migration. They look at refugees and asylum seekers and the different types of people that migrate. I picked this up with one A-level revision site for one particular exam board, and they talk about elite migrants, low-wage migrants, and internal rural to urban migrants. But the elite migrants, they include footballers, the 330 premiership players who are of African origin. And then what you do is look at a different perspective. It's still exploiting exploiting the hopes and dreams of many would-be footballers who don't realise that they're not going to make that path, but that's what they're looking at. I'm a little out of date because I'll be talking about Didier Drogba because I don't know the names of the new ones, and that was what I was doing when I was teaching. You've made me look at it in a different way. I was looking at it from a view of elite footballers, not the ones who didn't make that elite level.
Yeah, and that's a really great point in terms of, again, tying some of these broader discussions together in the sense that those elite African players that we see in the Premier League and other parts of the world, they're the kind of tip of the iceberg, right? What that hides are the 99.9% that are never going to make it in the professional world of football. And a broader point, a really great scholar in Switzerland at Neuchâtel named Raphael Pouli, and he did some great work in the early 2000s showing how the majority of African players play in Europe's low-level leagues. I'm not going to say any particular leagues out of respect, but they're not in France, Germany, Italy, England, Spain, the big five. They're in the low-level leagues, and we don't really know that they're there. I know they're there because I look at this world. But many of us think of the elite level, as you say, and that kind of almost masks what's going on at a much broader structural level for the majority of players. And last but not least, these young boys that I talk to in West African context, that's what they aspire to become. And I'm smiling because when I did a lot of my field work 10 years ago, I've done some more recent, but the work that I published and we're talking about, they were talking about Didier Drogba, Samuel Eto'o. Those are the players that they were talking about. Those are their reference points at that time. Michael Essien and Assamoah Gyan. You know, those are reference points at that time. So you're not too far off, John, actually, with Didier Drogba. And so yeah.
You do critique top-down accounts in your paper, and that's the sort of story I think that most A-level students will get. It'll be a top-down picture of migratory patterns rather than the stories of Gerard and...
But just to follow up on that, John, I think that it's a top-down picture, but it's a very particular type of top-down picture. So, I'm not going to ask you how long you taught geography for, but how often did a textbook talk about the capitalist nature of the migration system? How that system is driven by capitalism. And, so my point is that even when we do have a top-down approach, it's a very particular type of top-down approach that often masks more than it often reveals about the structures driving what we're seeing. And I think that's where we live in a current climate where there's often talk about not politicizing the classroom, for example, and being very careful about certain narratives and conversations. But I think we do our students a little bit of a disservice when we give them half the picture. So again, with these kind of top-down structural narratives that we present, there's often some bits and pieces, well, fundamental bits that are missing. As I kind of just gave an example there, the economic system driving migration processes in the current day is often, we talk about globalization, for example, but we don't often explain that it's a very particular type of globalization that we've encountered over the last however many decades. So great point about the top-down approach. That's what I try to tease out in my work by bringing these kind of voices to the fore of various participants that I've been fortunate enough to work with and speak to over the years.
Well, you talk about how long I've been teaching geography for. Here's a perspective on a young boy watching the 1966 World Cup. There are two things that I reflect on now. When we beat Argentina, the commentator was talking about hot-headed Captain Rattan, who was sent off. And South Americans are hot-headed. And that's one of the things that means that they're not quality footballers, apart from Brazil, of course. And the other thing that was said was that Africans are individually brilliant footballers, but can't organise themselves into a team. So that's why there are no African football teams in the World Cup. This was in 1966. This geographical sort of determinism is what I grew up with.
Yeah, and it's still quite powerful today. I'll give an example. So when I was doing some work with the young players in Ghana, I was talking about their aspirations, why they want to be footballers. And you'd be surprised at how many of them reproduced quite racist ideas about the black body, about how they're naturally gifted, how they're stronger, they're faster than people from other parts of the world. So my point here is that these kind of racial stereotypes and discourses, they circulate, they move around in lots of different ways, and they can be internalized and ingrained, right? And so your point there about organization and skills, even to this day, I think there was a controversy a few years ago in France, and I won't name the names of those involved, where a quite high-level professional coach was overheard making quite racist remarks about French athletes, French footballers, along the lines of what you were saying in terms of what they could and couldn't do, along the lines of their racial characteristics. So these things are still, that they're still quite prominent today. So that's a really great point about 1966, we're in 2023, and things have moved a little bit, but maybe not as far as we would have liked.
Once they're here, I was really quite sad to read what Gerard had been saying. You wrote it in terms of beyond a sense of shame, but they've come, and if they don't make it, there's the problem of what they do next.
Yes, so, and this is where the issue of football trafficking and human trafficking in sport, there's lots of problems with it, but this is one example of where it gets quite tricky in the sense that when a young player, if they're under the age of 18, they end up in a destination country. And I was working primarily in France for my field work. Often the intermediary, the so-called agent, would take their documents, their passports, and therefore the player often couldn't verify their age. So they'd often have to go through various social services and there'd be attempts to check their age. If they were found to be over the age of 18, the aim was to repatriate them and send them back to their country of origin. Often that's not where the players wanted to go, right? So they'd often, I wouldn't say go underground makes it sound far more kind of clandestine than it is, but they would in fact almost try and disappear. They'd try and move in with the local diaspora and go under the radar. They start working informally in many cases. They basically live an undocumented life because they didn't want to go back. And to be very clear, this is partly because of shame. If your family have sold huge swathes of land, other things to get the financing for you to go to Europe to become a footballer, you don't make it. There is a level of shame there. But the reason why this also becomes a bit more problematic in the eyes of charities and other organizations is that the boys do want to stay in Europe, regardless. And what that then does is, and you and I had a chat beforehand about, recent government plans to, increase the cost of getting a visa to come to the United Kingdom, the money you need to show you've got in terms of your dependents, all those types of things. There is the hostile environment towards migration, right? So these young boys often get caught up in this where they're very nervous about showing that they want to stay in Europe because people then might accuse them of not being true victims of trafficking, right? Oh, you made this all up, you concocted it, you're not really a victim. You're an economic migrant who wanted to come to Europe, and these quite hostile discourses and narrative become attached to them. So, yeah, they often, A, they don't want to go back because of a sense of shame. But I had a really great exchange with a few of the boys, and they said to me, when they say to their family in this, they were from Cameroon, so our family back in Cameroon, that life in Europe is quite hard. You know what their family says to them in Cameroon? If it's so hard, why don't you come back to Cameroon? If it's finding it so difficult, why don't you come back? And then they say, we're stuck, right? We can't say anything because we don't want to go back. So they say, well, if it's, if it's that hard, you come back. And there's this whole tension around wanting to stay in Europe, but then being perceived as being economic migrants who then aren't worthy of support. And it's quite a tricky terrain for them to navigate. But the majority, as you kind of hinted at the start of this conversation, they tend to try and go a bit underground, and yeah, try not to engage with other social services and work in industries that are maybe more cash in hand. I don't want to portray them as being criminals, but yeah, they kind of move into the underground, the more off the track type of lifestyle.
The GEO's Geography Quality Marks are prestigious awards which recognise, reward and promote quality and progress in geography leadership, curriculum development and learning and teaching in schools. A powerful process of self-evaluation and reflection, the frameworks incorporate the key messages of the 2019 Education Inspection Framework, supporting schools to develop a curriculum with high quality intent, implementation and impact. As a school working towards the award, you'll receive access to support, guidance and exemplification of quality geography through our webinars and online portal, and assessment and detailed feedback on your submission so that you know where to focus your next steps. You'll also become part of our international network of over 1,500 Geography Quality Mark schools. For further information or to register for the 2023 cohort, please go to our website at geography.org.uk.
You've set a 10-step guide. I don't know whether I can put you on the spot and see if you can remember all 10 steps, but it was about addressing that confusion and misunderstanding that occurs.
Yeah.
About this process.
Yeah. So I could, of course, John, without a doubt, I could give you all 10 right now. but I think what I'll do instead is we'll probably share a link in the alongside the podcast and say that the key thing I wanted to highlight is that there's often two processes happening, sometimes concurrently or sometimes separately. What we call trafficking in football and trafficking through football. So trafficking through football, to summarize, is broadly where an agent or intermediary will use football as a way to trick somebody and exploit them, normally for financial gain. Whereas trafficking in football is where somebody will actually be signed for a club under exploitative terms that would meet the definition of human trafficking. The reason why those two processes matter is that trafficking through football, and this is a bit confusing, it's called trafficking through football, but it might not always meet the definition legally of human trafficking. And that's basically because there's certain criteria that need to be met in terms of an act, a means, and an end. So the act of moving people around through a means, forms of clandestine transportation and fraud, to the end of exploitation of financial gain. As weird as it sounds, sometimes trafficking through football doesn't meet all three of those criteria, whereas human trafficking in football, where someone is moved for the purpose of exploiting them in the industry, does meet that criteria.
Well, yeah, I think the summary is a good one, and people can then follow it up. I just think it's important that you've got these steps that clarify what could be otherwise a confusing process. And you've also made it clear that for some of the migrants, although they're not a success, making it out of West Africa to Europe's their success, yes. Even though they don't make it as a successful footballer.
Yeah, so on this point about the success, it's been quite subjective. So some of these players, and Gerard articulated this really well in one of our conversations, and I think it's in the paper, he says, and it's quite a sad way to put it, but he says that, think of it as though we're prisoners in a jail. And when you're in a jail, everybody wants access to a lawyer. If there's not lots of lawyers, people stay in the jail and they suffer. We see these agents as being like the lawyer. We're struggling. And the lawyer is the light that comes to save us. These agents are like a lawyer. If you're in prison, they come and they're the ones who save you. Not everybody gets access to that lawyer. If I'm lucky enough to have access to that lawyer and to make it to Europe, that's my success. But to your point about success taking different forms, exactly. So for many of these young people, being a footballer, of course, that would be fantastic. They'd love to be a professional footballer. But just getting out of their context and making it to Europe is a success in of itself. As I tried to hint earlier on, they've got to be very, very careful saying that, because they then come into narratives around being an economic migrant, being a bit disingenuous, not being sincere, being sincere about why they're actually in Europe. So, but it's a great point, John, that yes, for them, even making it to Europe is a sign of success, but that can be used against them in the current hostile approach to migration. And in terms of the conspicuous margins, the bit that I forgot to say would be that, that another reason to look at the margins linked to bell hooks' great work is that the margins can also be sites of resistance. Right, that's where often some of the resistance happens, is on the margins and the fringes. So the margins aren't always places of deficit and deprivation. I think they can actually be quite beautiful, quite vibrant, quite creative spaces. So even when I look at the experiences of young West African youth being trapped through football, their ability to survive, to navigate these difficult contexts in often quite creative ways, some would say cheeky, I'd say creative ways, is also quite, it's quite radical. It's a form of resistance, you know, and I think that their attempt to get to Europe by hook or crook is their way of trying to navigate and survive in quite difficult contexts. So again, that the margins are a place of what Hooks calls radical possibility. So again, that's why I quite like to look at these so-called conspicuous margins. And it also, lastly, it's because it's humbling, right? I think that as an academic, you know, in our so-called ivory towers, I'm always very mindful of not forgetting where I come from in many ways. I think this helps to keep me a little bit grounded in my work, which is, yeah, it's easy to lose sight of those types of things.
I'd like to ask you about a research paper that you were involved in. This was a little while ago now, wasn't it? The New Development Frontiers, because that you looked at the role of youth sport and cultural interventions to investigate their role in promoting sustainable development among young people in low-income countries. Was that in an attempt to encourage young people to see their future in their home country through those same sorts of sport, cultural, and educational frameworks?
Yeah, so that project links nicely to our initial conversation about the conspicuous margins. So this is a project with Professor Richard Giulinotti, Dr. Martha Saavedra, and Professor Sagar Sharma, who are the co-investigators in the project. And we looked at youth who are leading or actively involved in trying to realize development agendas, be it poverty alleviation, gender equality, climate action, in Cape Verde, Timor-Leste, and Nepal. Now, these are relatively small states. So again, this point about the conspicuous margins. So these are nations that are, due to their size, often the margins of global debates and conversations, but they're highly conspicuous because of climate change, the impact that climate change is having on them disproportionately. All right, so that, again, this idea of the conspicuous margins kind of comes through and why I was quite keen to work in this context. But to answer your question more directly, again, this was a really fascinating project, getting a sense of what young people are doing to try to create a better future for us. So as I said, these organizations were trying to use sport, art, cultural practices, such as trekking in Nepal. In Timor-Leste, they're using forms of kind of martial arts, self-defense, to empower girls and young women. They're also using a range of activities to try to highlight issues around climate change, to change practices and behaviours. Really fascinating project, really humbling, actually, to see what young people around the world are doing, often with quite limited resources. So yeah, that was a really fascinating project. And again, this idea of the conspicuous margins, you've got young people in Cabo Verde, Timor-Leste, Nepal, often, as I said, on the outskirts of global conversations, generally speaking, but on the front line of climate change and really trying to do something to improve our futures. So.
And it leads me rather nicely into the next question I was going to ask you, because in contrast, the other paper that I looked at, where you picked up this phrase, boys are tired, youth urban struggles and retaliatory patriarchy. And I saw the graffiti that you'd seen on the wall that possibly sparked this thought process off, but the graffiti was no woman, no money, no crime.
Yes, so this is, you shouldn't, it's like your children, you shouldn't have favorite papers, right? But this is one of my favorite papers because it was a paper that actually the idea for it started almost 10 years ago. And it took a while to write it up. So the wider context of this is that a few years ago, myself and Ebenezer Mankwa and Peter Mensah were working on a different project that involved interviewing young people. And we picked up on some quite troubling narratives coming from the young men about how society was working against them because they were men, and how the world is favouring women at their expense. And again, you've highlighted or made reference to some graffiti that we saw on the campus of the University of Ghana: "No women, no money, no crime." So this kind of low-level misogyny that was kind of surfacing in the society. And I flagged that context now because we think about recent debates around kind of toxic masculinities. And here, I'm not here to kind of pass judgment or to get into the rights or wrongs of what these people are doing or not doing. But the broader point was, we're picking up this conversation around masculinity and this idea that men were suffering at the expense of women's gain. That's kind of how I'd articulate it. And so Peter, Eben and myself decided to do a bit of research into this and actually start to speak to young men. But what we did was we used a very famous song in Ghana called "Boys Are Tied" by a late musician called Guru. And that song kind of articulates this concern about, you know, boys being tired, about the world not quite taking care of boys in the way that they should. And so what we want to do is just to dip into this conversation and get a sense of what's happening. And in doing so, we kind of teased out kind of three overarching themes that we saw coming through. So one was this idea of entitlement. So young Ghanaian men thinking that they were better suited to certain positions or authority, more deserving of opportunities and special treatment because they were men and their social status as men, and becoming resentful when they didn't get this entitlement, when they didn't get this treatment, and the belief that this was happening at the benefit of women, right? And also being oblivious to the fact that actually young men and women are both suffering in society, you know, that patriarchy and other forms of inequality are oppressing men and women. So it's quite a powerful paper. But I think what we hope, well, I hope we did quite well in the paper, is also not to to downplay why the young men felt the way that they felt. Not to say we agree or disagree with it, but not to downplay that they felt the way that they felt for a particular reason. That, and the reason they felt this way is that their society as a whole wasn't living up to their promises or expectations they wanted it to live up to. And they were then blaming that on women. But the reason the society wasn't living up to the expectations is linked back to issues around neoliberalism, the economy, inequalities in society, that gender inequality is part of those issues. It's not the cause of those issues. So I think we try to tease that out, I think, quite well in the paper. But to go back to my initial point, I think that that paper speaks really nicely to broader conversations happening around kind of gender equality, masculinity, that have come to the fore quite a lot recently. And crucially, it introduces a West African perspective to these conversations. I think we often think about these issues in a very Eurocentric way. And again, we forget the conspicuous margins, right? There's lots of young Black men in other parts of the world who often have views and thoughts on gender equality. We try to tease those ideas out in the paper. But as I said, a key thing I want to emphasize is that we weren't trying to cast a judgment on these young men for feeling the way they felt or thinking what they felt. We want to understand why they felt the way that they did. I'll give one example. One example that the young men gave of why they felt society was working against them was a famous scandal that actually made the UK press, where lecturers at the University of Ghana were having sex with girls in exchange for good grades. And the young men we spoke to said that that's an example of how society favours women over men, that they can have sex with lecturers and get good grades and we can't do that. So, you know, it's an example that I think articulates how problematic what they're thinking is, right, you know, but also how they're not quite grasping that this is part of a broader issue of patriarchal oppression. The fact that someone can use their power over a young woman to have sex with them in exchange for grades isn't a good thing. That's not a good thing.
And I think what it shows is it's always easier to other a group rather than look at a complex set of explanations. And that's simple. It's their fault, rather than look at a complicated set of social, economic, and political ideas. Rather, that's too complicated.
Yeah, and within the paper, we tried to situate and articulate how a lot of the issues they've got in terms of unemployment, access to opportunities to travel, disillusionment with education, they can be tied back to structural issues in society in terms of structural adjustment, neoliberalism, you know, that their structural causes the way that they're feeling, the way that they feel. However, they're not able to articulate, or actually they're not able to identify those causes. And instead, they divert their kind of irritation towards women. right, without realizing that actually women are also suffering from the same structural conditions that the men are. So we try and end the paper by trying to call for solidarity in understanding these issues and to actually start to turn our attention towards the real causes of these challenges that the young boys are facing.
Well, that brings us right the way back to where we started, really, about looking at the world in a geographical lens, because a geographical lens, which can look at long distance and close up and can focus on issues at different scales, allows us to ask those questions. And perhaps that's something that's missing in their education, which I suppose brings me back to a question I wanted to ask earlier on, but didn't. I know you've done a fair bit on your contribution to debates about reforming the geography curriculum. We're running towards the end of the podcast, but what are your key thoughts on how we might look towards a different view of the geography curriculum for the future?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think I started to hint at some of these points earlier on. I think one of the challenges with the geography curriculum at times is that it's not particularly geographical. And what I mean by that is that we don't use our geographical concepts and lenses as astutely as we should do. So again, I know I've used this example before. I'll go to this point about comparison, right? So a key part of the geography curriculum, especially school geography, is about comparing places, right? But unfortunately, because the way the curriculum's constructed, that comparison falls into hierarchization, right? It's about creating hierarchies and it amplifies differences and overlook similarities. So I think one thing the curriculum would do far better is think about the ways which we're similar, actually. I think one thing we do quite a lot is emphasize difference. And the reason why looking at similarities is quite important is that it helps to humanize our curriculum and start to see people in different parts of the world as being a bit like us. They might be different, but to start from the point of making it a little bit more humane. So I think pedagogically, that's quite a key thing to start to think about, is how we can make our curriculum a bit more humane. And I think a key way to do that is to think about how we compare places, people, context as well. I think another area that we need to really start to think about within the geography curriculum, and again, it's quite a subtle one, is something we talked about today, is how do you bring those different voices into the classroom? And at the moment, one of the ways that we do that is often through textbooks. But I think now with the way technology is advancing and changing, I think there can be far more dynamic ways to bring different voices and perspectives into the classroom using technology. And I think that will make a real massive difference to enriching and enlivening our curriculum in quite dynamic ways. And, you know, but I don't want to forget this. There's some great people, for example, Iram Sama, Hafsa Garcia, Nona Anderson, Dan Whittle, Chris Winter, Shakira Kasuji, Rachel Robinson, Dave Rees, Kit Marie. I'll go on and on. There's a really great group of school geographers, often associated with a group called Decolonizing Geography, who are doing some really amazing work on thinking through these questions, John, actually. Now, how can we have a curriculum that is far more humane, far more considerate of different perspectives, and actually far more geographical, you know, to put it really bluntly, to make it a far more geographical curriculum, you know. And as I kind of hinted, I think we could talk about this all day, but I think one of the key issues in the curriculum is around how we view different places and people through a lens of comparison. I think you'd be surprised at how much of a difference we can make to our curriculum if we actually started to break down the way in which we try and compare different places and eradicate this emphasis on hierarchies and difference. And before I forget, there's a really great group of scholars in the 1980s who did some really good work on trying to, yeah, kind of transform geography. And they had this series, I think it's called Contemporary Issues in Geography Education, CIGE. And I think the late Dawn Jewell was really influential in driving that work. And the key point is Contemporary Issues in Geography Education were doing some really great work in the 1980s around some of these themes. And I just flagged that because we don't need to reinvent the wheel. I think sometimes we start from scratch when actually there's some really great resources that we can draw on in the not too distant past.
I do think your point about voices is a real key one for me. It's when you see young people talking about their place, but they're not miserable. It's not the image that we get on the news, but it's people jolly who have the same sense of humour, who are the same in many other ways. It's the similarities far outweigh the differences, but you don't see that through a textbook and you don't see it through graphs and through those sorts of approaches.
I think that your point about voice is very important. I do really believe that at the moment, the resources that teachers have to rely on to bring out these voices from different parts of the world are a little bit inadequate. I won't name a publisher, but I'm doing some work with various publishers at the moment, trying to look at textbooks in geography, school geography, and how we, because that's still a very important resource, right? How we can do that work better. And the key point you raised there is about voice. You know, whose voice is heard? How's that voice heard? How's it represented? A lot of work really needs to be done on that front. I mean, it's a podcast in itself, talking about the pedagogy, how we teach, why we teach. But to your point, I think this idea of voice is really important, representation. You know, a common reflection I often hear is, can I see myself in the classroom? And often when a child can't see themselves in the classroom, or when they do see themselves in the classroom, it's a deficit model, that can do really harmful things to someone. And I think to our earlier question about why is our curriculum so white and the impact it's having on children is that many young people don't see themselves in the geography curriculum, right? And that's where, for me, the work that I've done, you asked about why do stuff on Black populations. You'd be surprised that when I lecture or when I give talks at schools, how Black people like the fact that I'm doing work about us and them, right? Right, you know, and to see themselves in the curriculum, but to see themselves not in a negative way all the time. Yes, the stuff about football trafficking itself is quite negative, but if you read my work, you find that there's lots of stories there about joy, happiness, fun, everyday life amongst Black young people. So I think people find that quite kind of, even the stuff I did around Boys Are Tired, I've shared that with friends and family. They said, it's a difficult read, but it was a fascinating read because I didn't know that people were thinking that, or I did notice that, oh, that's interesting, right? You know, so I think that can be quite powerful. And the final thing I'd also add on that point is that they often say to me afterwards, I didn't know this was geography.
Oh yeah, that's a common one, I think, with those sort of approaches.
They often end and say, I didn't know this was geography. And that allows me to have a really great conversation about what geography is and what geography isn't.
My last question, and I think you've just about fully answered this anyway, was just to say, what about the future? But I think you've told us a little about the future, your future. Where do you want to go next? What do you want to do?
Yeah, so I think there's two key directions in terms of my future. One is the more academic side. One is the more kind of think about the discipline. I know those two things are not separate, but in terms of the academic side, I'm really keen to continue this work around the conspicuous margins and looking at the experiences of Black populations that may not get the attention they probably deserve, even though they're highly visible. So I'll give you a very quick example is that I'm fascinated by the experience of old people in African cities, right? So we often think of Africa as a youthful population. And to be very clear, I know people have looked at gerontology, which is a technical term for aging studies, for decades. But there isn't that much in geography about the experiences of old people generally, but old Black people. So I'm very keen to look at the experiences of old people in African cities and how they navigate the city, how they experience city life. And that actually links to broader demographic trends, because while Africa is often seen as being quite a young continent, people are living longer. You know, people in Africa are living much longer now due to advances in medicine, all sorts of things. So the talk now is that actually, you know, decades from now, Africa's going to have quite an aging population. What does that mean? What do we do? What would that look like? So I'm thinking about those questions now, intellectually. So that's kind of the work that I'm doing. In terms of my future in the discipline, I'm currently a trustee for the Geographical Association and the Royal Geographical Society. I think I might be the first person to do both at the same time, which is a random factoid. So for me, as I kind of hinted at the start, the older I get, the more I care about the discipline and its future. And I want to be part of conversations about how we have a future that is far more dynamic, dare I say, far more diverse, far more inclusive, all those things, but also, as I said, far more humane, you know. And I think there's some really big questions at the moment, be it around migration. We talked about what's happening in the UK, our approach to migration, but in other parts of the world. Big questions around the climate, environmental justice. These are very geographical questions. And I think geography needs to be part of those conversations. I'm most struck by how rarely I see geographers in the public domain actually having these debates and conversations. I feel that we need to be part of them. So I'd be quite keen to support the discipline in that sense. And in terms of being a trustee, I always think it's an opportunity in a space like this to just flag to listeners that, you know, being a trustee is a great thing to be able to do. To be very, very clear, we don't run the organization. We're not part of the day-to-day operations of the organization. It's very much about, the word I'd use is a custodian. You're a custodian. Your job is there to almost be a critical friend and provide, ensure accountability and checks and balances are in place to ensure that the organization has sustainability. That's kind of what a trustee does. So we don't run day-to-day operations. Well, we shouldn't be doing that. our job is to make sure that that organization, that charity, is able to sustain itself both today and moving on to the future. And of course, the Geographical Association, the RGS, they're fundamental to our discipline and its future, right? So I've been trying to play an active role in those organizations, both in terms of the research side, but also the teaching and learning side of things. So that's where I'm going to divert my energies moving forward, I think. I'm also really looking forward to the GA conference in Manchester in 2024. Denise Freeman is our president for the year. Denise has been doing a fantastic job over the last few months organizing, and I'm really looking forward to giving a presentation there. I haven't written it yet, but it's on its way.
Well, you've given me a fascinating insight into a different view of geography. Preparing for this podcast has been a delight. I've really enjoyed it, and thank you very much for agreeing to chat to me.
Thanks, John. I really appreciate it. I've had a really good time, and I hope that our listeners take something from this.